beautiful. So thank you so much for your service. Well, brethren, as we know, this is the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Traditionally, the church has taught that this was the day that God separated the waters of the Red Sea so that the Israelites could escape from the armies of the Pharaoh and move on into the wilderness of Sinai. During that time, the Israelites had seen so many miracles. In fact, just the miracle of parting the sea, where millions of people could walk through that to get to the other side. They'd seen the plagues in Egypt. They'd seen the pillar that followed them and led them. By day, it was a nice cloud, give them shade. At night, a light and a fire to give them warmth. They saw all of this. And despite all of these miracles that they'd witnessed, they still murmured against God and longed for the days in Egypt. Let's turn to Exodus 16:3. Exodus 16:3. We read there, it says, "And the children of Israel said to them," you know, they were speaking to Moses and Aaron, "they said, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Eternal in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and we ate bread to the full. We were able to fill our stomachs. For you have brought us into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger." They felt like they were starving to death, that God had forsaken them. And they murmured against God and against those that God had chosen to lead them along the way. Again, in Numbers, the 11th chapter, Numbers 11, verses 4 through 6, we see another example of their murmuring. It says, "Now the mixed multitude who were among them," so this was those that were not Israelites, this mixed multitude that accompanied them on their journey away from Egypt, "this mixed multitude yielded to intense craving. And so what happened? So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic.'" I had no idea what a leek was. Sherry looked it up last night for me, and it's kind of like an onion. It's got a slightly different flavor. Don't know that I would enjoy it myself, but the Israelites were craving. They had all that when they were in Egypt. But now they say, "But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes." They're tired of manna already. They want what they had in Egypt. Again, after all they had seen, after all these miracles that had been performed and bringing them out of a life of slavery, they were ready to go back into that bondage. They lusted after the life they had before and the pleasures they had while they were in slavery. Brethren, there's a lesson to be learned from the actions of Israel. And there is a warning to God's people. So this morning, we're going to look at the mistakes that Israel made. And we're going to address that warning given to God's people from a voice in heaven to God's people that cries out, "Come out of her, my people." This warning comes from the book of Revelation. Turn over to Revelation 18, verses 4 through 5. Revelation 18, verses 4 through 5. We read here, And this is a vision that John is having. He says, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities.'" Come out of her, my people. If you're looking for a title for this sermon, that's your title. Come out of her, my people. In this vision, John had shown the fall of a world system and a great fall that's going to be when Babylon falls. But you may be thinking, well, Mr. Giddens, that's got to do with the future. That's future Babylon. We're talking about coming out of that system. Brethren, that's a warning for us throughout history. It's a warning which is so needful in every corrupt state of society. And if you look at society today, you can see that it's about as corrupt as it can get. But I think they're going to get even worse. We're to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. We have to practice that separation from the spirit of this world. And it's essential, lest we become entangled in the meshes of their sinful habits. The important thing we need to take from this prophecy is that we should come out, lest we receive the plagues that will be brought down upon that system. Israel came out of Egypt. They were called out of Egypt. God basically had said, "Come out of them, come out of her, my people." Israel was his people. Egypt was a type of Babylon in that sense. And they were protected from the majority of the plagues that were brought down on Egypt. Yet we see Israel wanting to return to that way of life. I don't know what they would have had to return to. Most of the armies had been destroyed in the Red Sea. The country had been devastated by plagues. Did they think they really had something to go back to? But they remembered the good times. They thought of the good days. What they wanted to experience, what they wanted to go back to and have once again. They didn't want to be in the wilderness. They didn't want to eat manna. They wanted the good things in life. Brother, we've also been brought out of the ways of this world. This is what these days represent, our coming out of this world, coming out of a life of sin, coming away from that bondage. And we do that through repentance and baptism. And as we've been observing these days of unleavened bread, we do this as a reminder of our coming out and doing so. Coming out of her. But brethren, we have to be careful not to fall into the trap that Israel fell into, that of desiring the leaven of this world, desiring to go back to the good old days, as we may think of them. We don't want to go back to that. The book of Psalms 106, the chapter of Psalms 106, it's a beautiful psalm to read through. And it pictures what happened with Israel, despite the unwavering goodness of God. Despite everything God had done for them, it's recorded here in Psalms 106 that their attitudes. See, Israel forgot the good things that God had done and instead focused on their sufferings, their discomforts. They weren't focusing on the miracles that were performed in delivering them from a life of slavery, a life of bondage. Let's look at Psalms 106. Look at a few of the verses there. Psalms 106, we'll read verses 6 through 7 here. It says, "We have sinned with our fathers. We have committed iniquity. We have done wickedly. Our fathers in Egypt did not understand your wonders," speaking of the wonders that God had performed. "They did not remember the multitude of your mercies." The multitude of your mercies. "But they rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. Didn't take them long, 7 days into their journey, and they were already murmuring after they crossed the Red Sea. God's response to their wickedness, verses 8 through 13, nevertheless, regardless of what they had done, regardless of their murmuring, he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make his mighty power known. He rebuked the Red Sea also, and it dried up. So he led them through the depths as through the wilderness. He saved them from the hand of him who hated them and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. The waters covered their enemies. There was not one of them left. Then they believed his words. They sang his praise. Oh, they were rescued at that point. They sang his praise. They glorified God. Then verse 13, they soon forgot his works. They did not wait for his counsel. Dropping down to verse 21, it tells us there that they forgot God, their Savior, who had done great things in Egypt. Won't read all of Psalms 106, but we see Egypt's response, or the Israelites' response to all the good that God had done. Verse 14 shows that they lusted and they tested God. Verse 16, they envied Moses. Verse 24, they despised the pleasant land. And also in verse 24, they did not believe God's word. In other words, they didn't believe God would be able to deliver them into the new land. Verse 25, they murmured. Verses 19 through 20 and 36, they went after false gods. They built a golden calf to worship. Verse 33, they rebelled against his spirit. In verses 37 through 38, it's a horrible thing. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons. This is how Israel repaid God for all he had done. They fell into these things, into the world around them. God's response, after all of this, he was still willing to offer them mercy in their times of need. Verses 44 through 45, we read here, it says, nevertheless, regardless of everything that had happened, he regarded their affliction. When he heard their cry, and for their sake he remembered his covenant, and relented according to the multitude of his mercies. What love God has shown for his people. Despite everything that Israel had done, he was still willing, when they called out, when they cried to him, to forgive and to rescue them from their afflictions. We know that their coming out of Egypt and heading to the promised land it's a type of our coming out of sin, out of that spiritual Egypt, and heading to the kingdom of God, which is our promised land. We have to ensure, brethren, that we don't find ourselves doing what the Israelites did. That's there for us to read. We don't want to repeat history. We see what they've done and what happened. They ended up going back into bondage and slavery again, with Assyria, with Babylon, because of their willingness to forget their God. Hebrews, the third chapter, let's turn to Hebrews 3. The author of Hebrews sums up the actions of Israel very well in Hebrews chapter 3. Let's read a little bit here in Hebrews 3. Let's go down to verse 14. We read here, for we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. Don't be like the Israelites. Don't harden your heart. For who, speaking of the Israelites, having heard rebelled. Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? Israel went back into a life of sin. They wanted that life that they had in Egypt, where they didn't have any laws to abide by. And whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest? But to those who did not obey. So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. They were not allowed to enter the promised land because of their unbelief. They believed that God was not able to keep his promise to give them this land. They saw the giants. They thought, God can't do this and bring us in there. We don't want to go in. It's a land filled with giants. We're like grasshoppers compared to them. The next chapter of Hebrews 4, verses 1 through 2, it says, therefore, because of your rebellion, therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. He wants us to think about that. Are we coming short of entering into that rest? For indeed, the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. Many of us here today have come too far in our journey to face failure at this junction of our lives. We don't want to have come this far in our race, this marathon that we're running, to just give up and want to go back to Egypt. It shouldn't even enter our thoughts of wanting to go back. But there have been those that have done so. There have been those that gave up and went back to the world. Now, did they think they were being rebellious? Probably not. They didn't think that they were practicing false worship. But they decided they wanted what the world had to offer. They wanted to go back to a way of life that they may have lived prior to coming into God's church. And we don't want to make those same mistakes. We need to learn from Israel what happens when you want to go back. We don't want to forget all the wonderful, the great things that God has done for us, the mercies that he's shown to us, the miracles he's performed for us, the healings. We don't want to forget those things and turn our back on him. We don't want to doubt God's power. We don't want to test God. We don't want to rebel. And we don't want to lust after the things of this world and become so absorbed in it that we fall into its ways once again. Come out of her, my people. What's the world like today? It's not the same world our parents and our grandparents grew up in. Today, it's all about relativism. There's no absolutes. Do whatever you want. Who are you to judge one another? If I see things as being right, then that makes it right, because it's what I want. You can't judge someone's values or their way of life. And we saw that's what they wanted at first. Well, don't judge us because of our lifestyle. But it's gone even further than that now. It's not only you can't judge us, you have to accept it. You have to acknowledge it. You have to affirm that they're good people, that their lifestyle is good. And that's what they expect out of us today. They look at Christianity as not being morally superior to any other religion. And unfortunately, much of Christianity has adopted and tolerated the sins of this world. It's not so bad. We just need to show love. And that's what they're having. They're having love for one another. But do we find ourselves looking back and longing to this world? After all, wouldn't it be so easy to live in this kind of world where there are no absolutes, nobody's going to judge you for what you do? Wouldn't life be so much easier to do it that way? You know, this Feast of Unleavened Bread pictures God calling us out of Egypt, as I've mentioned earlier, out of its ways, out of its influences, its way of life. It's a picture of God saying, come out of her, my people. Now, we might look back on the Israelites, look at what they did, their rebellion, and think, how could they be that blind? Now, we can sit here comfortably and look at what they did and say, how could they be so blind after everything they'd seen? And they're willing to go back to a life of bondage just so they can have their food, have their comforts, have their pleasures. But you know what? Human nature hasn't changed through the ages. We still have that same human nature that the Israelites dealt with. And we can all find ourselves falling into the same pitfalls that they did. They found themselves being absorbed into teachings and the cultures around them. And how easy is it for us to just become a part of the culture and society around us and not really look at it? To illustrate this tendency, I'm going to bring out something that I'd never really thought about before. I read a blog post. It's called Sabbath Thoughts. It's written by a young man. I call him young. He's probably in his mid-30s somewhere, but he's young for me. His name's Jeremy. And he writes this blog every week called Sabbath Thoughts. He's a very deep thinker. He addresses things that many times I think, wow, I never even thought about that. I never even considered that. But he had a recent blog during these days of Unleavened Bread, and he brought out an aspect that I had not really considered before. He asked the question as to how do we feel about leaven during these days? During these days of Unleavened Bread, when we've taken the time to put leavening out of our homes, we don't eat the leavening, how do we feel about leaven during these days? Are you revulsed by all things yeast? Do you get sick to your stomach at the sight of a hamburger bun or a donut? Ooh, that's a tough one. And these are good questions. And the answer is you probably don't get sick to your stomach thinking about it. In fact, some of us may be thinking, well, sundown hits tonight, I am out to get me a burger. I'm going to hit that White Castle or that Krispy Kreme. Just waiting for these days to be over so you can go back to eating leaven. But during these days, how do we feel about leaven? How many of us are missing right now that good burger from maybe your favorite burger shop? Or just can't wait to grab a slice of pizza? I hate looking through my email during these days because I'm bombarded with emails from Domino's, Pizza Hut, Wendy's, Burger King, Buffalo Wild Wings, all these tempting emails. Oh, we got a special. You know, this is the time to come in and get it. Well, you know, I can't do that. And that's not even to mention the commercials. If you're watching TV, you know, they get these close-ups of these delicious hamburgers and the buns that go with them. And the fact that leaven represents sin during this week doesn't take away from the fact that leaven products are delicious. I don't think there's one of you here today that would not say that leaven products aren't delicious. And therein lies the problem. Do we look at the sins that we need to eliminate from our lives as being repulsive? Or do we look at them as being delicious? Do we have those guilty pleasures in our life? And you think about that term, guilty pleasures. It means that's something you're willing to indulge in, but you know that it's wrong. Now, I'm not asking for confessions for everybody what their guilty pleasures are, but I'll give one of myself. I gave up drinking my Coca-Colas several months ago, but then it got to the point where I'd be out running errands. Oh, I'll just stop by the 7-Eleven or the Quick Trip, grab me a nice bottle of Coca-Cola, and I'll drink it before I get back home. So Sherry doesn't know that I had one. You know, throw away the, you know, pull up in the driveway and throw the bottle in the trash bin outside. Guilty pleasure. I know it's not good for me. I know I shouldn't be drinking it, but it was that guilty pleasure. What guilty pleasures do we have in our life? And it can be more than just drinking a soda. What do we do that we know what our conscience is telling us we shouldn't be doing this because it could be sin? So do we look at these sins as repulsive? Or are they delicious, like those donuts, those hamburger buns, the bread that you get at Longhorn Steakhouse that comes out all nice and warm and fresh? I believe this is a lesson we can take away from observing the days of unleavened bread. How long were we a part of the world before God delivered us out of it? How much of that past did we find enjoyable and find ourselves looking back upon that past with longing? Oh, those were the days of my youth. I had a lot of fun, and then I came into the church. Did you stop having fun? No, we had freedom at that point, freedom from sin. But we can hang on to those guilty pleasures of our past. 2 Peter, the first chapter, Peter talks about this. 2 Peter 1, we'll read verses 3 through 4. Peter writes here, as his divine power has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by glory and virtue, by which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that through these things you may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Having escaped, having come out of it, as God commands, to come out of her, my people. Just as Israel escaped from Egypt, we have to escape the corruption of this world. But Israel didn't seem to grasp what they had escaped from. They were ready to go back into that life for the benefit of the pleasures that they derived from it. The leeks, the onions, and everything else that they were longing for. Peter warned of false teachers who would attempt to lure us back into a life of bondage. These false teachers include more than just religious figures. They're not just false religious leaders, preachers, but they also include government leaders, school teachers, college professors, scientists, among others, that trying to lead people away from God. You look at the things they're teaching today. They'll try to convince you that what you believe is wrong, and they want to free us from that. Trust the science, they say. Trust the science, coming from people that ignore scientific evidence that men cannot become women. You know, if you're a man, you're a man. But they will deny that science and try to convince you that you're wrong for thinking otherwise, for holding biblical values. And they will try to teach you you're wrong, and they won't stop with just us. They will go after our children. Because if they can convince the children, then they've won an entire generation. My daughter just shared with us, she'd taken the boys, our grandkids, to the library, and my son Malachi loves penguins, and he found a nice book on penguins. And so he was reading it, and he brought it to his mom and said, "Mom, this book is bad." And looked at what it said, two boy penguins that are in love with one another. They go after the kids. And she had no idea that that was in there. And thankfully, they trained Malachi well enough that he knew that this was wrong. And he brought it to his mother and said, "This is a bad book, Mom." That's what we have to be aware of, these false teachers in this world, that they want to lure us back into a way of life that we've come out of. 2 Peter 2, verses 18 through 19. "For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise them liberty," going to make you free from these beliefs, "they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage." I'd like to read those scriptures again from the New English Translation. It reads, "For by speaking high-sounding but empty words, they are able to entice with fleshly desires and with debauchery people who have just escaped from those who reside in error." Talking about bringing people that have escaped, that they come out of this world, they entice them back in with all these tempting things. We have to be careful not to be fooled by this. It says, "Although these false teachers promise such people freedom, they themselves are enslaved to immorality. For whatever a person succumbs to that he is enslaved." We don't want to go back into the bondage and the corruption of this world. But Satan will make the pleasures of this world seem more desirable than your calling. "Come out of her, my people." Brethren, we're in a war. And I woke up about 4 o'clock this morning, and God decided then it was time to talk to me about my sermon and start putting more thoughts into my head. And this was one of the things that came into my thoughts. I was just going to mention that this is a war that we have to win. But I got thinking about this. You know, war isn't just one battle. War, you know, like if you look at World War II, it was a series of battles. And you either win a battle or you lose a battle. We lost a Pearl Harbor because we weren't prepared. But we won battles like D-Day. We lost at Dunkirk. But we won Okinawa. We won D-Day. We won battles that helped secure our overall victory in World War II. But all it takes is one battle that you lose. I think of Napoleon. He lost at Waterloo. one battle, and he lost his war. Brethren, we're in a series of battles on a daily basis against Satan. All we have to do is lose one battle that could take us completely out of the church of God. God gives us the resources to fight these battles. He's given us armor. We have to have a plan. We have to know what we're going into. Because if you go into a battle without a plan, you're surely going to lose. So we have to think about these things. We have to study the scriptures and learn. Put on that armor of God. 1 Peter 2:11 tells us, "Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." We're in a war. We're in a war against fleshly lusts that Satan tempts us with. Titus 2, verses 11 through 12. "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age." What is this fleshly, this worldly lust? How do we overcome? How do we resist it? How do we win these battles? Well, the word lust comes from a Greek word that means a craving, a passionate desire. Now, this can be good. You can have good lusts, these passionate desires. But there's the bad, too. It depends on the context. For instance, Luke 22:15, at the Passover, Jesus Christ said to his disciples, "With fervent desire, with passionate desire, I've wanted, and I've desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." That's a good type of fervent desire, a passionate desire of wanting to do something. But you have the opposite side of the coin, the fleshly, the worldly lusts. The word "world" comes from the Greek word cosmos. Greek grammarian Kenneth Wist wrote that the cosmos refers to an ordered system. In this context, it is the ordered system of which Satan is the head. His fallen angels and demons are his emissaries, and the unsaved of the human race are his subjects. Together with those purposes, pursuits, pleasures, practices, and places where God is not wanted, much in this world system is religious, cultured, refined, and intellectual, but it is anti-God and anti-Christ. That is the cosmos, the world in which we live. Satan is the author of the thinking of this world. He influences the culture, the philosophy, the education, the religion, the media of all societies. God is not the author of wrong desires or cravings. He doesn't tempt us with fleshly desires, worldly desires. Paul writes to the Corinthian church. The Corinthian church had to deal with these type of issues. In 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, read verses 11 through 12. 1 Corinthians 2:11-12. "For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, not the spirit of Satan, but the spirit which is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God." That Holy Spirit that guides us, directs us, gives us strength. John tells us what the spirit of this world produces. We turn to 1 John, the second chapter, 1 John 2, verses 15 through 17. We're told there, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. Come out of her, my people." Don't love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, The love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, which is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. In this context, it is referring to evil cravings, evil desires. When we hear the word lust today, we must understand the context that's being used in. The lust of the flesh that John talks about here, that's anything that pampers the fleshly appetites of the body, indulging in physical things that appease our sensual desires. The lust of the eyes is that which is designed merely to gratify the sight. This would include costly clothes, jewels, splendid palaces. And that's not to say that that's wrong to gratify our sight, or that it's sinful to find pleasure in beholding objects of real beauty. It only becomes a problem when it is the great and leading object of life. If that's what we're living for, then we might need to give some thought to what's most important in our lives. When it's sought with no connection to the spiritual, it leads to coveting, breaking of one of the commandments. And then you had the pride of life that John described. Pride of life is an arrogance produced by material possessions, in which material security of one's life and possession produces this boastful overconfidence, the vainglory of life. The person that's described here is one that operates on a purely human level. They're not led by God's Spirit. They have no spiritual dimension to their existence. Their focus is entirely centered on this world and everything that it has to offer. And we have to be vigilant that we don't find ourselves drawn back into that. They have no love for God or for the spiritual things in life. And this brings us back to the lessons of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Paul tells the Galatians the same thing he wrote to the Corinthians. Galatians 5:9, Paul tells them, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. We can't let a little bit of sin take root in our lives, because it will leaven the whole lump. If we allow a little bit of this world, it can take us out of God's church. It could be the battle that we lose, and we lose the whole war. We've been called out of the bondage of corruption of this world. We've been called to liberty. Again, in Galatians 5, and we'll read verses 13 through 17. Galatians 5:13 through 17. For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. There's how you win the battle. Walk in the Spirit. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. Paul knew that he had those battles all the time. He talks about doing the things that he doesn't want to do and not doing the things that he should do. He understood these battles that go on within our flesh. The answer is to walk in the Spirit, to let God guide us in all things to strengthen us to fight these battles. We have to put aside the lusts of this world, come out of her, and instead let our conduct be directed by God's Spirit. I want to read Revelation 18, 4 through 5 one more time. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, unless you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. We have to come out of her. We don't want to share in her sins. We don't want to benefit from sin. You see sin happening. So sins that crucify Jesus Christ. Do we want to take benefit from that sin? Do we want to participate in it? Certainly not. Israel failed time and time again to come out of this world. They escaped bondage in Egypt. I mentioned earlier only to face bondage again under Assyria, Babylon, Greece, the Roman Empire, all because they forgot their God and turned back to the pleasures of this world. Israel was not able to come out of Egypt on their own. They didn't just decide one day they were going to leave, but it took God's strength. They needed help. They couldn't do it by themselves. It was God that heard their cries. It was God that performed mightily and awesome miracles to free them from Egypt. We need to learn from the mistakes of Egypt, or mistakes of Israel, I should say. We need to recognize that it's impossible for us to come out of this world on our own, because we will be pulled in by the lustful and prideful ways of this world without God's help. God sent his help in the form of his Holy Spirit. We must walk in the Spirit and not let it be extinguished in our lives. Hebrews 2:3 tells us, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed by those who heard him? Listen to that warning, brethren. The days of unleavened bread don't end. At sunset tonight, we don't end continuing to examine ourselves, as Mr. Lasaya brought out. It doesn't stop at sundown. We have lessons to learn. We have to continue in self-examination on a regular basis so that we don't allow the world to come back into our lives. We are commanded to come out of her. The AFV version, it's a faithful version, says, come out of her, my people, so that you do not take part in her sins and that you do not receive of her plagues. Come out of her. Now then, with a quote from Jeremy, who wrote the Sabbath Thoughts, his final thought was, the leaks just aren't worth it. Don't go back to them.